evening, everyone. Very thankful to the elders for offering me this opportunity to be with you for the next 4 weeks. We'll be diving into some topics that I think touch us all, that are universal in nature. And we'll be using the book of Job as sort of the backbone for this particular study. We won't have the time to go book, chapter, verse. It's 42 chapters long, but thankfully there's a great deal of repetition in the book of Job. So we're just going to be hitting the highlights and talking about some of the perspectives that are voiced by Job and his companions, as well as God in that book. Before we actually get into Job, I want to lay a foundation this evening by just considering from a broad perspective the topic of evil. Many of you are aware that for the past 9 or 10 years, I've overseen a website. It started out as onetruechurch.net. It transitioned to letsreasontogether.net a few years ago. And over that course of time, I've had about a dozen different brothers in the church help me write articles, record videos, and I'm very thankful for their good work down through the years. A few years ago, a brother wrote a blog post that over the course of the last couple of years has risen to be the most viewed article on the site. Last year, it received 9,435 visits. And at this point, as of a couple of weeks ago, in 2017, it had already received 4,265 views. Now, I see numbers like that, and as an evangelist who's running a site that's intended to reach out to the lost, I think to myself, what subject is that? That obviously is a subject that speaks to a lot of people. The title of the blog is Psalm 73. Why does God allow the wicked to prosper? That blog entry is far and away the most viewed blog entry on the entire site. It was written by my brother-in-law, Richard Garby. And from that article, there have been several people that have taken the time to write comments. And they're people that range from people of faith to atheists. Now, I'm calling them people of faith because I don't know whether or not these folks are Christians. I don't know them personally. The Lord knows those who are His. I can tell, though, based on their comments, that they have at least a nascent understanding of the Bible and a belief in Christianity, a belief in Christ and God. But I don't know what their status is, so I'll just call them people of faith. And we've also had atheists comment on there as well. One man wrote that he views the God of the Bible as both unjust and capricious in his actions, which just sort of fits into the modern-day atheist view of the Bible. Another man wrote a very expletive-laden comment that expressed real rage against God, once again to be expected. But there have been people of faith who have made comments. One lady wrote a very heart-wrenching, heartfelt comment where she just sort of poured herself out. She talked about how she and her husband tried to be good people. They went to church, but they were tormented by his ex-wife. She was treating them very cruelly, and this had gone on for years and years and years. And in her frustration, she says, "Why is God allowing this to go on? We're good people. We try to do the right thing. Why is God allowing this woman to torment us?" And I have to admit, her question struck a chord with me. Because like a lot of us, that's the same sort of question we've asked ourselves in the past. Why does God allow adverse circumstances to go on and on with apparently no end in sight? As you can see, this particular blog really speaks to the universal struggle, a struggle that people of faith and atheists alike wrestle with. Why is there evil in this world? And in particular, from a righteous person's perspective, if you will, why does God allow the wicked to prosper? But when you flip that question over, it leads to the next question, which is the subject of my study this evening. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? Why does He permit this to take place? As I said, this is really the flip side of that question that Richard asked in his blog entry. Why does God allow the wicked to prosper? Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? To answer that question, I think we first need to begin by defining what is evil. And the definition that most defenders of the Christian faith have landed on in the last, 16 centuries or so, is that evil is a real lack, a privation, a corruption of a good thing. That word privation is probably a little recognizable to you. It's the word that we get the word deprive from. A privation is a lack of some necessity, some basic necessity. So, for example, the absence of food during a time of famine would be a privation, hence an evil thing. So down through the centuries, defenders of the Christian faith have sort of arrived at this consensus that evil is a corruption, a lack, a privation. Like several people, I'm a beneficiary of having read some books by some people who are very good thinkers on this topic. One of them is a little book called If God, Why Evil? It's been recommended publicly in the past by a good brother in Christ, and I picked it up based upon his recommendation. And one of the points that he makes in that particular book is that evil cannot exist on its own. And if you think about that definition, it makes a great deal of sense. In order for evil to exist, there first must be good that exists. And he illustrates this by using three analogies. He says that evil is like rot in a tree. Tree is a good thing. Rot is an evil thing. But rot cannot exist without a tree. By definition, rot demands the existence of the tree in order to exist itself. He compares evil to rust on a car. Once again, rust demands the existence of a good thing, metal. In order for this evil thing to exist, there must first exist a good thing. So rust becomes a corruption of what is good. It doesn't exist in and of itself, but it corrupts what is good. He offers a third analogy. He says that evil is like moth holes in a wool sweater. Once again, the wool sweater is a good thing, but moth holes cannot exist without the wool sweater. So in this way, and I think that this is a very solid definition with real biblical backing, you can see that without good, evil cannot exist. Evil depends on there to be good. That brings me around to looking at evil from a biblical perspective and considering, well, what are the types of evil that are out there? So we know that evil is a lack, it's a corruption, it's a privation, but what are the types of evil that the Bible describes? I think there are two major categories of evil. There's what I'm going to call moral evil. And this is, I think, fairly self-explanatory. Sin, of course, would qualify as a moral evil. Performing an act that is wrong in the eyes of God, that would be a moral evil. But to that, I would also add the consequences for sin. The consequences that we experience for sin can be, in many respects, an evil thing. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8 teaches us this principle very clearly. Paul says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." The evil that comes from sin, or one of the evils that comes from sin, are the consequences that we suffer for sin. And they're not just consequences that are eternal in nature. There are consequences that we can suffer in this life for our sins. And I might add, we can also suffer consequences for the sins of other people as well. Other people commit sin, and those create consequences for me. I would also put in the category of moral evil, we have situations where people are victims of malicious intent. Victims of malicious intent. A person intends to harm or to injure another. This would fall under the category of moral evil. We have a lot of examples in the Bible of this. I think of Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, after he had stood toe-to-toe with the prophets of Baal and Asherah and had proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that God, Jehovah, was the one true and living God. He had executed the prophets of Baal. And for that, he was driven into the wilderness by Jezebel, who wanted him dead. Elijah was a victim of malicious intent. Here was a woman who wanted to destroy him. This is obviously a reprehensible act, hence a moral evil. I think of Hannah in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 1. Hannah, who suffered immensely because of the cruel treatment of her husband's other wife over the fact that Hannah could not bear children. Once again, a woman who was a victim of malicious intent. And I would also put in this category Satan himself. Satan, the fact that he presents temptations to us, the fact that he influences events against us, is an agent of moral evil. Peter describes Satan as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. That's malicious intent. Satan is a moral agent, and thus his activities fall under this branch of evil I'll call moral evil. But there's more, there's another type of evil that I do want to mention. What I'm going to call natural evil. Now remember, the definition of evil that I'm operating from is a corruption, a lack, a privation. All I mean by natural evil is the forces of nature that have been set in motion by God. Let me give you a few examples. Ebola would be a natural evil. Cancer would be a natural evil. Earthquakes, volcanoes, typhoons, and the suffering that they bring as a result of them would be a natural evil. God has set these forces in nature. He has set them in motion, and they do bring evil into people's lives. I think of the beggar, the blind man in John chapter 9, who didn't have his sight. That is a lack. That is a privation. Here is something that is very necessary that he does not have. That's an evil thing. Now, he's received that because, most likely, because of some genetic material that's been passed down either from his parents or from someone back in his family tree. But he's suffering under the yoke of an evil thing. He should have his eyesight, but it's not there. And yet, this is not a moral act, as Jesus is quick to point out in that passage. He's not suffering from blindness because of some sin he committed or some sin his parents committed. He's just blind, and he's been blind from birth. Therefore, it would fall into the category of natural evil. Now, between these two, I think we have something that sort of could fall under either one. We have the idea of time and chance. Let's take a moment to open our Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. Solomon says this: I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. There is such a thing as being a victim of circumstance, as being a person who's just simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, like a fish that's caught in a cruel net, like birds that are caught in a snare. Evil times can come upon you completely unawares. I mean, what does James say in James chapter 1? He talks about falling into trials. It's not something that you have orchestrated on your own. It's not some sort of consequence for an action that you have performed in the past, but rather something that's happened apart from your control. And sometimes those fall into the category of time and chance. We just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. For an example of that, I think of the Tower of Siloam that Jesus talks about in Luke chapter 13, verse number 4. He talks about how this tower had fallen on these people. And his point in that passage is to encourage us to realize that that tower didn't fall on them because they were evil, because they were wicked or unrighteous. It just happened. And those sorts of things happen. It has nothing to do with whether a person is good or bad, righteous or unrighteous. It just simply happens. They happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Time and chance, as Solomon says, happen to us all. So as I think about evil and why bad things happen to good people, I first must begin by defining what evil is and then also considering the types of evil talked about in the Bible. Two major types, moral and natural, and really time and chance could happen as a result of either. I don't know really where to put that. I don't think it really fits into either category. It could be one or the other, or it could be neither of them. But I've been talking for about 15 minutes, so I'll open it up. Any questions or comments so far? I did have a presentation, but the projectors is failing. Time and chance happens to us all, right? We've got a real lack here. Any questions or comments? All right, one of the questions that a skeptic... Well, let me back up here. Let me get to one other thought before I get there. If we just go back to the question, why do bad things happen to good people? I think that we have to acknowledge, based upon what we see in the Bible, that evil things that happen to people, that evil does not play favorites. Evil is not a respecter of persons, as the King James would put it. Remember Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8 that I quoted a little bit earlier. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever man sows, that he will also reap. That's a warning to Christians, right? That's a warning to people who are believers, who are, assuming, the righteous people. Evil things can come upon a good person. Sometimes they could be the consequences for some sin that they're just having trouble getting out of, some habit that's deeply ingrained. God doesn't play favorites in this regard. He's put this law in place, this law that is absolute, this law that cannot be avoided, and there's no escaping it whether a person is righteous or unrighteous. Evil does not play favorites. And I think you all would agree that as we look at Scripture, good doesn't play favorites either. Think about what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 45. He talks about his Father who makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. God is no respecter of persons. He doesn't play favorites when it comes to the sun rising or rain falling upon the earth. He doesn't play favorites there. So if good does not play favorites, it seems to me to be logical that evil would not play favorites either. Acts chapter 14, verse 17 is another example where we see God doing good for people who, by the strictest definition, would be wicked. In Acts chapter 14, Paul is in Lystra with Barnabas. They are preaching the gospel to people who have lived for generations as pagans. And Paul is trying to reason with them that there is this God that exists. And he says in verse number 17 that he's left them a witness. What is his witness? Well, that he did us good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. You see, God does good even to those who don't acknowledge his existence, who are ignorant of him, and who, by the strictest definition, are wicked. These are people who have lived in ignorance of the true and living God, and yet he has done good to them. God does not play favorites when it comes to things like this, when it comes to the good that he has shown toward us. I think by just a little bit of reasoning, we can see that evil would operate the same way. falls upon both the just and on the unjust. But I want to start circling back to that good man Job. And we're laying a foundation this evening to talk more about him the next couple of weeks. But Job, in the second chapter, verse number 10, says a very admirable thing. All sorts of horrible things have happened to him before this point. The Sabaeans have raided and robbed him and killed his servants. The Chaldeans have raided and robbed him and killed his servants, two examples of moral evil. His children were all in their brother's house when a windstorm came up and knocked the house over, killing everyone inside. An example of natural evil. Job has been covered from head to foot with boils. Very, very painful. Once again, a natural evil. All these terrible things have happened to Job. His wife says, "Why do you hold to your integrity? Curse God and die." I love Job's response in verse number 10, the second sentence. He says, "Shall we not accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" There were some things that Job got wrong in the book, and we're going to talk about those in a couple of weeks when we talk about Job's part of the discourse. But there are some things that Job got very right. And even though he wrestles with this problem of why evil times have come upon him, and he wrestles with it mightily, he acknowledges from the outset that even bad things can happen to good people. Evil does not necessarily play favorites. One final question that's often asked by the atheist, and I think is worth bringing up this evening. Okay, we've got this thing we call evil. And a lot of people want to know, did God create evil? Is God responsible for evil in some way? Remember in Genesis chapter 1, verse 31, God created, had finished his creative acts at the end of the sixth day. He's hung the stars in heaven, the sun, moon, and stars. He's separated the land from the seas. He's filled the land with vegetation. He's filled the seas with fowl. He's, with fish. He's filled the air with fowl. Yeah, that would have been interesting, right? He's created man and woman, and he looks back on all of his creative acts, and he sees that everything was what? Everything was good. Everything was good. You see, evil is not a thing. Evil is the corruption of a good thing. When God finished creation, he looked and saw that everything was good. God created everything good. Evil is not a thing. Therefore, God did not create evil. That's the conclusion. So why did evil come upon us? Well, the Bible offers the answer that evil is present with us because of immorality. That it's through moral evil that evil has entered into the world. I like Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse number 29, because I think Solomon puts this idea very succinctly. He says, God has made man upright. God has made man upright. And the second half of that verse is escaping me, so I'm going to have to turn over there and read it. Thank you. It sought out many schemes, right? Man started out as good, but instead of following after the will of God, man followed his desires. Man pursued his desires. And this is what has introduced evil into the world. Of course, what we also learn is that as a consequence for moral evil, God has imposed upon man a natural evil. What is the punishment for man's sin? It's death, right? This is a natural evil. Death is our enemy, right? Death stands opposed to us. And death is a corruption of the good thing that God has created for man. In Romans chapter 5, verse number 12, Paul says that through one man, sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death has spread to all men because all men have sinned. Later on in the sixth chapter, verse 23, he says the wages of sin is death. So as a consequence for the moral evil that man committed, God has legislated a natural evil as our punishment. So as I look at what the Bible has to say about evil, and I ask myself the question, did God create evil? I must walk away with the conclusion that God did not create evil. He created man good. He created all things good. But he did create the possibility of evil. He did create that as a possibility. Why? Because he gave man free will. He gave man the power to choose. And he says to man that you can eat of any tree of the garden, except for one, of the knowledge of good and evil. And if you eat of it, you will die. Man had a choice. And because man had been given the power to choose, we can say that God did create the possibility of evil, but not evil itself. Evil has come into the world because of man, not because of God. I'll pause and ask any questions or comments before I start to transition over to Job. Any questions or comments? Yes, go right ahead.
I don't know if it'll just muddy the waters, but as I've thought about that question you initially asked, looked at my life and that roller coaster of ups and downs and ins and outs and suffering, I think as you look at the whole picture, this is just encouraging to me, so sorry if I'm saying something not biblical, but
go ahead.
Without pain, without loss, without suffering, I think it's almost impossible to really know what love and God is all about.
Absolutely.
And it, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, but at least it gives us some type of a baseline for it.
Yeah.
As you ever look at something like James 1:2, which I talked about before the tornado even hit, you know, consider it pure joy when you endure trials of many kinds. It doesn't make any sense. But without that pain, without those hard times, the love that we can share with one another and the concern that we have for one another wouldn't be there.
Yeah. Yeah, people often ask the question, well, why did God even give man free will to begin with? Well, I think it's because we wouldn't be able to come to understand and be able to carry out true love. That's why the possibility has to exist. So I agree with you. And what we endure in life, the disappointments, the adversity, the challenges, can help us come to appreciate the love of God to a deeper extent. And I would also add to that, we can come to appreciate the love that others have for us to a deeper extent as well. Thank you. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Yeah, Randy, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, they certainly would be part of this natural evil punishment, wouldn't they? That work, I mean, God had intended for man to work from the very beginning. He had given man these duties in the garden. So it's clear that work was a part of God's intent for us. What we see, though, afterwards is that the difficulty of labor would be increased as a result of the immorality of man. So I assume that those thorns and thistles, the possibility of them, were present in creation and came forth as a result of man's sin. But, I mean, that's just pure speculation on my part. Did you have a follow-up? Yeah, I do definitely see the Garden of Eden as being the ultimate. And that's what is restored. That's what Alan read from Revelation chapter 21, that all things have been made new and you know, the curse has been removed and God has restored that relationship with he and man. I think that's what God had intended from the beginning. But because of man's sin, that was lost. Gerald, go ahead.
Romans chapter
That process brought on by sin in the world causes us to long for something more, something beyond, something permanent, something safe.
What does Peter say in 2 Peter 3? We look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein righteousness dwells. I think that's part of the hope that Paul's talking about here in Romans 8, that it's got to be better than this, right? It's got to be something better than this. So yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, Art, go ahead.
I agree with what you say, that people doesn't originate from God. Why would he put a tree in the garden?
Well, that's a good question. As I say, I think the possibility of evil would be present, but I'm not certain that evil itself would be present in that act. I think that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is simply a way of giving man a choice, either to choose God or to follow after their own desires. As Eve looked at that fruit, she saw that it was pleasant to the eye, that it was able to make them wise, and that excited some sort of desire in her. And then she gave it to Adam, who I believe is the real one who's guilty. Eve was deceived, but Adam was the one who was guilty. So I see the tree not as evil, but rather as representative of the choice that God gave to man. Are you going to follow me, or are you going to follow what you want to do in the end? But I may be wrong on that, but that's how I see it. Did you have a follow-up? Yes. It awakened something in them. Absolutely. It awakened they were able to see themselves in a way that they had not seen themselves before. Absolutely. Yeah, Randy, go ahead. Yes. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Yeah, Gerald, go ahead.
What pleases God, what glorifies God, is when we make the choice to believe and trust Him. If we had not the choice, what would be the glory of making the choice?
And as we're going to see here in a couple of weeks, and I'm running out of time very quickly here, but just to circle back around to Job and to put a little bit of a concluding stamp on this evening, you know, when God responds to Job in chapters 38 through 41, after Job and his friends and Elihu have had this very long discourse, in God's response, He never really answers Job's question as to why all these things have taken place. His words, I believe, are intended to humble Job, to give him the right perspective of who God is and who Job is in comparison. And by implication, I think what God is saying to Job is, you just need to trust me. I am the one who hung the stars in the heaven. I am the one who created the earth to hang on nothing. I am the one who have given the limitations to the waters. I am the one who has created all these things. Job, you simply need to trust me. And to me, that's an incredibly comforting idea, because there are things that happen in life for which we cannot ever find an answer to the question, why? There are. And we may never know. We may never know in this life. So I think God's response to Job is instructive to all of us. And that is simply, we may not understand why. We simply need to trust. Trust and have faith in the one who holds all these things in the palm of his hand. Thanks for being here this evening. I look forward to being with you next week. Next week we're going to talk about Job's friends, how they were poor comforters, how they got a whole lot of things wrong as they tried to tell Job why he was going through these very difficult times.